A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
200. Maybe 250. That's how many languages on Earth have at least 100,000 speakers but aren't global giants. Out of roughly 7,000 living languages, the comfortable middle class of human speech is a few hundred members. Daniel's been thinking about this from inside one of them.
Hebrew, yeah. 10 million speakers, give or take. Which puts it right at the top edge of what Daniel's calling the middle ground.
His prompt is basically this. The distribution of world languages is wildly uneven. A handful of languages with hundreds of millions of speakers, an enormous long tail of tiny endangered ones, and in between, a band almost nobody talks about. He wants to know how many languages sit between the top handful and the 100,000 speaker floor, whether there are million-plus speaker languages most people have never heard of, how speaking a mid-sized language shapes the culture it produces. And he's got a specific observation from Israel, which is that when your language is only about 10 million speakers, you place a high priority on learning English or another major language, and you also get a kind of cozy culture. A creative scene with relatively few well-known actors. He wants to look at the pros and cons of living in a smaller linguistic bubble, and he points out that people who grew up speaking English or Chinese structurally can't know what that's like.
Which is the sharpest thing in the prompt, I think. The structural unknowability. If your first language is the market, you never feel the market pressing on you.
So let's start by actually counting.
The shape of the distribution first. You've got maybe 10 languages that each have more than 100 million native speakers. English, Mandarin, Hindi, Spanish, Arabic, Bengali, Portuguese, Russian, Japanese, and depending on how you count, a couple more hovering near that line. Those 10 cover something like 4 billion people between them. Then you drop steeply. The next tier, languages with 50 to 100 million, is thin. After that, you're in the middle ground we're talking about.
And the tail is where the mass of languages actually lives. Something like half of the world's 7,000 languages have fewer than 10,000 speakers each. A quarter have fewer than 1,000. The median language on Earth has a speaker population smaller than a mid-sized town.
Right. So when Daniel asks how many languages have at least 100,000 speakers, the answer lands in the low hundreds. If you count down from the most spoken language to the point where you hit 100,000, you've passed maybe 250 languages. 260, depending on whose counts you trust and how you split dialect from language.
250 out of 7,000. So the vast majority of the world's languages fall below that line. The middle ground, Daniel's describing, is about 3.5% of all languages.
And that 3.5% is doing enormous cultural work. But before we get to that, the second question. Million plus speakers, completely off most people's radar. I've got four that I love.
Go.
Aymara. About 1.7 million speakers across Bolivia, Peru, and Chile. It's a major Andean language. It has a written literary tradition. It's co-official in Bolivia. And most English speakers have never heard the word.
I hadn't until I read Daniel's prompt and went looking.
Tigrinya. Roughly 9 million speakers, primarily in Eritrea and Ethiopia's Tigray region. It's the working language of an entire country, Eritrea, and a major regional language in Ethiopia. It has its own script, derived from Ge'ez, and it's essentially invisible in the Anglophone world.
There's a whole country running its government, its courts, its schools in a language that most people couldn't place on a map if you gave them the map.
Sylheti. 10 million plus, concentrated in the Sylhet region of Bangladesh and in the British diaspora. London has a Sylheti-speaking community large enough that it shapes entire neighborhoods. And yet if you ask someone in London what Sylheti is, most will say they've never heard of it.
Including people who live two streets from a Sylheti grocery.
And the big one. Fula, also called Fulfulde or Pular, 25 million or more speakers spread across the Sahel from Senegal to Sudan. It's a major trade language, it has a huge oral literary tradition, it's spoken across more than a dozen countries, and it's almost never mentioned in Western media.
25 million speakers. That's more than Dutch, more than Swedish, more than Greek, and most people have never heard of it.
That's the misconception Daniel's pointing at. A language with millions of speakers isn't necessarily well known. The Anglophone mental map of world languages is shaped by which languages appear in the news, in travel guides, in the languages offered on a phone keyboard. Not by speaker count.
So why is the distribution so uneven? Why did some languages scale and others not?
The short answer is that language size tracks state power. A language gets big when it's attached to an empire, a state, a bureaucracy, a school system, a printing press. English didn't become English because it's intrinsically better at describing things. It became English because it had the Royal Navy, then the British Empire, then the American century.
And the languages that stayed small mostly stayed small because they never got a state.
Standardization is the mechanism. A language that gets a dictionary, a grammar, a Bible translation, a national curriculum, a broadcast network, it scales. It becomes the thing you learn in school, the thing you do business in, the thing you write your laws in. A language that never gets those institutions stays a spoken vernacular, passed from parent to child, and it stays small.
Hebrew is the weird outlier in this story. It had all the standardization, the dictionary, the grammar, the sacred texts, centuries before it had any speakers.
Right. Hebrew was a liturgical language for nearly 2,000 years. People read it, wrote it, prayed in it, wrote poetry in it, but nobody used it to buy bread. It had no native speakers from roughly the 2nd century until the late 19th century.
And then Eliezer ben Yehuda decided his son was going to grow up speaking it, and the whole thing went from liturgical to living in a couple of generations.
The ben Yehuda household was a linguistic hostage situation, as you've said before.
I stand by it. You don't get to choose your language environment when you're a toddler, and your father's life project is making you the first native Hebrew speaker in 2 millennia.
But the result is that Hebrew is now a 10 million speaker language with a full modern vocabulary, a national academy, a school system, a broadcast media ecosystem, a tech sector. It's the rare case of a language that was revived from the top down rather than grown from the bottom up.
Which is probably why it feels different from other 10 million speaker languages. It has the institutional density of a much larger language.
Hebrew punches above its weight institutionally, which brings us to the second language imperative.
Daniel's observation is that in Israel, learning English isn't optional enrichment. It's infrastructure.
And he's right. When your domestic market is 10 million people, you can't be self-sufficient in science, in technology, in scholarly publishing, in entertainment. The market is too small. So the professional class learns English because the professional literature is in English. The export market is in English. The venture capital term sheets are in English.
It's not a choice. It's a gravity well. If you're a software engineer in Tel Aviv and you don't read English, you're cut off from the documentation, the forums, the conferences, the entire global conversation in your field.
And this is the thing speakers of major languages don't experience. If you grow up speaking English, the world's scientific literature is in your native language. The biggest movies are in your native language. The internet's default is your native language. You never face the moment of realizing that your language isn't the market. The market is somewhere else.
A Mandarin speaker has a version of this, though weaker. The Chinese domestic market is big enough to sustain its own tech ecosystem, its own entertainment industry, its own scientific publishing. A Chinese speaker can have a full professional life in Mandarin, but even then, the global layer is English.
And for a Hebrew speaker, or a Dutch speaker, or a Danish speaker, there's no full professional life in the native language, not in most fields. The Dutch have known this for centuries. They've been running a small language economy since the 17th century, and the entire country is functionally bilingual.
The difference is that Dutch speakers learn English because it's useful. Hebrew speakers learn English because it's the difference between participating in the global economy and not.
Let me push on that slightly. I think it's the same for Dutch. It's not optional there either. The Dutch academic system runs on English at the graduate level. Dutch universities teach master's programs in English because the student body is international and the literature is English. A Dutch physicist who can't read English isn't a physicist.
There. So, the second language imperative is structural for the whole middle ground, not just Hebrew. The question is what it does to the culture.
Daniel's cozy culture observation. This is the part I find most interesting. When your language has 10 million speakers, the pool of well-known actors, musicians, writers, public intellectuals is small enough that the audience and the creators are unusually close.
The Israeli entertainment industry is a great example. There are maybe a dozen actors that everyone knows. Not a dozen leading actors, a dozen actors, period. If you watch Israeli television, you see the same faces across every genre, every network, every decade.
And that creates intimacy. The audience has watched these people grow up on screen. There's a parasocial familiarity that's much denser than anything you get in a 300 million speaker market.
The flip side is that the budgets are small. An Israeli feature film costs a fraction of what a Hollywood film costs. The production values are lower, the talent pool is thinner, and the ceiling for a successful career is much lower in absolute terms.
But here's the thing. Small markets also mean fewer gatekeepers. When the stakes are lower, there's more room for experimentation. You can make a weird film, a niche play, an avant-garde album, because the cost of failure is lower and the audience is more forgiving.
The trade-off is intimacy versus reach. A Hebrew language artist can be a household name in Tel Aviv and completely unknown in Berlin. An English language artist can be niche in New York and still have a global audience of millions.
And that shapes what gets made. A small language culture produces work that's dense with local reference. In jokes, shared history, political shorthand. The audience gets everything immediately because they share the entire context. A big language culture produces work that travels, work that's designed to be legible across borders.
The Israeli startup scene is the sharpest example of the second language imperative in action. Israel has more startups per capita than almost anywhere on Earth, and almost all of them operate in English from day one.
Because the domestic market is too small to sustain a tech company. If you're building software in Tel Aviv, your first customer isn't in Tel Aviv. It's in New York or London or Singapore. So the pitch deck is in English, the product is in English, the support docs are in English, the company blog is in English.
The small linguistic bubble is both a constraint and a forcing function. It constrains the domestic market, but it forces global orientation. An American startup can raise money and find customers without ever leaving the English-speaking world. An Israeli startup cannot.
And this is why Israel's tech sector punches so far above its weight. The language constraint forces the entire industry to be export-oriented from the first line of code. There's no domestic fallback. You either go global or you don't exist.
I wonder if that's also true of the creative scene, not just tech. Israeli musicians who want a career beyond the local club circuit have to write in English or find some other way to cross the language barrier.
Yes, and that's the brain drain dynamic. The most ambitious creators in a small language market face a choice. Stay in the native language and accept a ceiling, or switch to English and compete in a much larger pool. The ones who switch are often the most talented, which drains the small language scene of its best people.
Which is one of the cons Daniel's asking about. The smaller linguistic bubble gives you coherence, low anonymity, strong in-group creative networks, a shared reference frame. But it also gives you limited market size, brain drain, and the risk that the language becomes a domestic-only medium while the prestigious work happens in English.
Hebrew is actually a partial counterexample because the revival project was so ideologically charged. There's a strong cultural norm that serious Hebrew literature, serious Hebrew theater, serious Hebrew scholarship matters. The language isn't just a tool, it's a project.
But even in Israel, the prestige work in science and tech is in English. The Hebrew language scientific literature is essentially non-existent. Nobody publishes cutting-edge physics in Hebrew.
Right. Hebrew is the language of the kitchen table, the neset, the evening news, the novel. English is the language of the lab, the term sheet, the conference paper. And that split is the defining experience of the middle ground.
So we know how many there are. Now, what does it actually feel like to speak one?
I think the defining feeling is that your language is yours, but the world is not. You have a complete, rich, emotionally saturated life in your native language. And then you step into the professional world and you're operating in a second language that you'll never quite own the way you own the first.
That's the thing speakers of major languages structurally can't know. They've never had the experience of being less articulate in their professional life than in their private life.
And it's not just about vocabulary, it's about register. You can be witty in Hebrew, and then in English you're competent, but not quite funny. You can be precise in Hebrew, and in English you're approximately precise. The second language is a slightly foggy window.
The cozy culture Daniel describes is the compensation. When the professional world is in English, the emotional world doubles down on the native language. The Hebrew language creative scene is small but intense. Everyone knows everyone. The audience is invested in a way that a mass market audience never is.
And there's a political dimension. A small language is always, to some degree, a project of survival, Hebrew especially, given the history. The revival was a nationalist project, and the language carries that weight. Speaking Hebrew isn't just communication, it's a statement.
That's true of a lot of mid-sized languages. Catalan, Welsh, Basque, Irish. They're not just languages, they're identity claims. The act of speaking them is loaded in a way that speaking English never is.
And that's both a pro and a con. It gives the language a cultural intensity that big languages lack. But it also means the language is constantly politicized, constantly under pressure, constantly having to justify its existence.
The middle ground is defined less by speaker count than by the structural pressure to be bilingual. That's the insight I keep landing on. A 10 million speaker language and a 50 million speaker language are different in scale, but they share the same fundamental condition. The domestic market is too small to be self-sufficient, so the professional class is bilingual, and the native language becomes the language of home, culture, and politics, while English becomes the language of work, science, and global reach.
And the pros and cons flow from that split. Pro, cultural coherence. The native language remains the language of intimacy, of humor, of shared history. Con, the prestige gradient. The most ambitious work migrates to English, and the native language risks becoming a domestic-only medium.
Pro, low anonymity. In a small creative scene, a talented person can be discovered and celebrated quickly. Con, limited market. The ceiling is lower, and the most ambitious people leave.
Pro, a strong in-group network. When the language community is small, the social fabric is dense. Everyone is 2 degrees from everyone. Con, insularity. The shared reference frame can become a closed loop, resistant to outside influence.
And the thing Daniel's pointing at, which is that growing up in English or Mandarin means you never experience any of this as structure. You might learn a second language, but it's a choice, an enrichment, a hobby. It's never the difference between participating in the global economy and not.
I think that's the deepest point in the prompt. The second language imperative isn't a lack of pride. It's not that Hebrew speakers love Hebrew less because they learn English. It's that the domestic market is 10 million people and the global market is 8 billion. The math is just the math.
And the math is brutal. 10 million speakers means the total addressable market for a Hebrew language book is maybe a few hundred thousand readers. For an English language book, it's hundreds of millions. The same novel, the same effort, the same talent, and the market is three orders of magnitude different.
That's why the translation industry matters so much for small language literatures. A Hebrew novel that gets translated into English doesn't just gain readers, it gains legitimacy. It enters the global conversation. The Nobel Committee isn't reading Hebrew.
Which creates a weird dynamic where the most prestigious validation for a Hebrew writer comes from being translated out of Hebrew. The language's greatest successes are measured by its disappearance into English.
And that's true for every mid-sized language. The Swedish Academy gives the Nobel Prize in Literature, and the winners are almost always translated into English before anyone notices. The original language is the source, but English is the amplifier.
The middle ground is a place of constant translation, constant code switching, constant awareness that your language is a home but not a market.
Yet, the middle ground is also the most stable part of the distribution right now. The long tail is collapsing. Languages with a few thousand speakers are dying at a rate of about one every few months. The giants are stable. But the middle, the 100,000 to 10 million band, is holding.
Why? Because these languages have enough institutional support to survive. They have school systems, broadcast media, literary traditions, national identities. They're not going anywhere.
Right. Aymara has co-official status in Bolivia. Tigrinya runs a country. Fula is a major trade language across the Sahel. These languages aren't endangered. They're just invisible to the Anglophone world.
The middle ground is large enough to sustain a culture and small enough to feel the pressure. That's the sweet spot Daniel's describing.
The pressure is productive in a way. It forces a kind of alertness. You can't coast on your language the way an English speaker can. You have to think about what your language is for, what it can't do, where its edges are.
English speakers can go their whole lives without ever thinking about English as a language. It's just the water. A Hebrew speaker thinks about Hebrew constantly, because Hebrew is always in negotiation with English.
With Arabic, in Israel's case. The linguistic landscape here isn't just Hebrew and English, it's Hebrew, Arabic, English, Russian, Amharic, French, Yiddish. The middle ground is never monolingual.
Which is probably why Daniel's observation about the cozy culture rings true. When the language is small and under pressure, the culture it produces is dense. Every Hebrew speaker knows the same songs, the same jokes, the same historical references. The shared frame is very tight.
That tightness is a real asset. It means a Hebrew language comedian can make a joke that lands with 90% of the audience instantly, because the audience shares the entire context. An English language comedian has to build the context first.
The trade-off is that the Hebrew comedian's joke will never travel. It's locked in the language. The English comedian's joke can go global.
That's the whole thing in one sentence. The middle ground is where the jokes are better and the audience is smaller.
That's the structural pressure. Now here's what it does to the culture.
The Antwerp office I worked in, the working language was a pidgin of Gujarati, Yiddish, and English that maybe 200 people in the world spoke fluently. This was late 80s. I was a shipping clerk for an import-export firm that dealt almost entirely in diamonds. The floor wasn't French, not Flemish. It was this thing. You wanted to talk about a shipment, you used it. You wanted to complain about the coffee, you used it. 200 people in the world, and 40 of them were in that building.
A trade pigeon. That's a whole category Daniel didn't even ask about, but it's the extreme version of the middle ground, a language that exists only for commerce.
The interesting thing, and this is the part I wanted to add, is that it wasn't a liability. It was a security feature. Nobody outside the floor could understand a word. You could discuss a consignment in the open, in the street, on the phone, and the language itself was the encryption. Outsiders couldn't eavesdrop. The language was a membership card.
The smallness was the point.
In that building, yes. You spoke the pidgin, you were inside. You didn't, you were outside. It didn't matter if you spoke perfect Flemish. The deals happened in the pidgin. The language was the vetting.
That's a case where the second language imperative runs in reverse. Instead of learning a global language to reach outward, the community built a small language to keep people out.
It worked. 18 months I was there, and I never saw a deal leak. The language was too small to leak.
I can still count to 20 in it. Ordered a sandwich in a Delhi hotel once using just the numbers and the word for bread. Got exactly what I wanted, which proves something, though I won't say what.
It proves that a language with 200 speakers can still get you lunch in the right context.
It proves the language was real. People used it to do actual things. Ship diamonds, buy bread. That's what a language is.
That's the thing the counting misses. A language with 200 speakers can be a complete tool for the people who use it. It doesn't need millions of speakers to be real. It needs a community.
The middle ground Daniel's describing is the same phenomenon at a larger scale. Hebrew with 10 million speakers is a complete tool for the people who use it. The pressure to learn English doesn't make Hebrew incomplete. It makes the market bigger than Hebrew.
The Antwerp pidgin didn't need English. It needed the Antwerp diamond trade. When the trade moved, the language probably moved with it, or died. I don't know. I left in 89 and never went back.
That's the open question, isn't it? What happens to the middle ground as machine translation gets better? If the second language imperative weakens, does the small language bubble get more viable or less?
I think more viable, actually. If real-time translation is good enough that a Hebrew speaker can read an English paper without learning English, then the structural pressure to be bilingual eases. The native language can hold more ground.
But then the prestige gradient might flatten too. If translation is frictionless, the advantage of writing in English shrinks. A Hebrew novel could reach an English audience without the author switching languages.
That's the optimistic view. The pessimistic view is that frictionless translation makes the big languages even more dominant, because the content flows one way. English content translated into Hebrew floods the market, and Hebrew content translated into English drowns in the noise.
The long tail is shrinking. The middle ground may be the most stable and most interesting part of the distribution, large enough to sustain a culture, small enough to feel the pressure.
The pressure is what makes it interesting. The middle ground is where language is always in negotiation, always code-switching, always aware of its own edges. Speakers of major languages never have to think about any of this.
Which is Daniel's final point. The experience of speaking a mid-sized language is something you can't know from the inside if you grew up in English or Mandarin. You can observe it, you can study it, you can empathize. But you can't feel the gravity.
The gravity of a market that's too small. The gravity of a professional life in a second language. The gravity of a creative scene where everyone knows everyone. That's the middle ground.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtopf for producing, and for the Antwerp Pigeon, which is going to be in my head all week.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you want to send us a prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.